If your morning starts with snap, crackle, pop, and it's not your cereal, call Joint Relief Institute for fast-lasting joint pain relief. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000.
If you had heard the things Johnny was uttering last Saturday night.
Oh, man. Actually, I don't remember last Saturday night.
I know you don't. Yeah.
I did go shopping, though. I do remember that. That's always dangerous.
In your head, you went shopping?
Never mind.
We have a full show tonight. In fact, let me quickly give you the rundown. We're going to catch up with two people tonight that we haven't talked with in much too long a time.
Yes.
Our friend Howard Levy, who is just a master at anything he wants to do.
Master musician and now a fabulous author.
Boy, has he got a great book. And we're not just saying that. Anyhow.
The book is titled I Speak Music.
And boy, does he.
It is absolutely the best titled book. As I'm reading the book, I said there could not have been a better title for this.
Yeah.
Because he speaks music.
And we're savoring it, too. So Howard's going to join us a little later tonight. Then also a little later tonight, our resident computer guru, Dr. Patrick Crispin, joins us, and among the things we're going to be talking about is TikTok USA, and is your smart TV listening to you?
As long as it can't,
short answer, yes.
Well, as long as it can't see me, I'm okay if it's listening. I don't want to be watching me.
And we will have some Super Bowl preview a little later tonight.
Yes, well, a little Super Bowl preview as well as a little conversation about what to eat on Super Bowl Sunday.
But also, before we get too far afield, hey, Ron.
Yes?
Have you seen the movie, what is it, If I Had a Leg, I'd Kick You?
If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. Yes, I have.
Okay. We recorded it. Because we're trying to see a lot of the new things that are, you know, things that are nominated for the Academy Awards. We had it all queued up, ready to watch. Talked with my brother.
Oh, he called.
And he said, don't. He said, it is possibly the most depressing movie he has seen ever.
Well, it's, yeah. It's anxiety filled. I mean, it's this poor woman. I kept saying that over. It took me two times before I got through it. The first time I watched it, I was like, that poor woman. Oh, my gosh, that poor woman. It's her in every scene, and she has an ill child, and she's trying to take care of the best that she can. At the same time, her house is about falling apart behind her. She has to move out and go to a motel.
And her husband's not on the scene.
And her husband is gone. So it is like, one scene after another, that poor woman. But it's a great performance by that poor woman, Rose Byrne.
Nominated for an Oscar.
She is nominated. I mean, I don't think that she will win, but it's great that she's nominated because it does highlight, it's a great performance. The camera is on her the whole time. So there's that's a reason to watch it. But yeah, it does overdo it, and it's just oh my gosh.
And we were glad to get the word from Lee, because with life today, we thought, you know, do we really want to go into another deep dark hole?
Come out of a weekend where I was just kind of not in the best place psychologically, because I just lost a few days of my precious life.
Yeah.
That's why he was calling. I don't think that's what you want to watch.
Yeah, it's not going to leave you whistling a happy tune, I'll tell you that.
It's not a rom-com.
No, it's not. There are plenty of those around,
yes.
Especially around Valentine's Day, that'll pick up your spirits.
All right. We're going to we're going to do a little taste testing, Ron, if you want to get involved in this. Engineer Bob, keeper of the big plug.
Yeah, you want to set this up, and we'll get to it a little later. But, Bob, you want to explain what you did?
Okay, so the last time you guys were actually here.
Just 2 weeks ago. I know it feels like so long ago since you missed us.
Someone mentioned, ooh, we need to try these gluten-free Cheez-Its.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was like, So I looked it up, and I looked on Amazon, and there were three different choices. So we have Annie's gluten-free. We have Y gluten-free, mm-hmm. and we have Cheez-Its.
The real gluten-free. Thing? The hottest thing out there.
They are so hard to find.
And it wasn't cheap. So anyway,
They're being hoarded.
Yes, they are.
And resold on eBay.
So I've got bowls. I've got sample crackers. And really? We'll let everybody give their
opinion.
Mm. And we already have one opinion in.
Oh, Krista?
Krista was nice enough to leave me her opinion.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And
so this we'll give means we can't seal up that box of Cheez-Its and resell it.
No.
Because they're going for $20-$25 a box.
Yeah, no.
Which is crazy.
I could have. I should have. Like, give you guys a tweezer of each.
And lifted it out and sealed it back up again. All right. Next Saturday, Valentine's Day.
Yeah, in fact, blatant plug for next Saturday. A, we have a full show. B, we're going to be connecting with a number of people mm-hmm. and getting their Valentine's story. Couples that you may know. One couple that you... I wonder how many people would remember.
It wasn't that long ago.
But it's been a while.
What's a couple decades?
John Duncanson and Sylvia Gomez.
From Channel 2, CBS. Yeah.
Just a terrific people. And they're
they met at the station. They married. They became regulars on our show, especially on Valentine's Day, because there were not a lot of couples working together in media at that time. And then there came a point in their lives where they said, you know what? We are just going to sell everything we own, and we're just going to get in a boat and just
they
sail
literally,
away.
They travel around the world.
And they just sailed
away.
They're
just having a great life, the two of them, doing all kinds of interesting things.
And that was even before the internet, so we couldn't keep up with them. And then when the internet came along, we could find out where they were in the world. And they've kind of settled in California, Mexico. It's very fluid. I was able to track them down, and she said, well, it's been a long time since anybody wanted to talk to us as Sylvia and John. So we'll do that next Saturday night.
Yeah. And we'll have some other people joining us who, some people that you've heard on the show before who are couples, and we're going to get their story. Yeah, so for those of you who are not fans of Valentine's Day, we're going to be talking Valentine's Day next week.
Yes. And in fact, I want to do something fun. We did this 100 years ago. In fact, it was right when we started taking text on the show. So that was probably over 20 years ago.
Yeah, when text, at least.
Yeah, when text became an element of the show. And we said, if you would like to have a special message sent out to that special someone, send it to us via text, and I'll gladly read them for you on the radio. And we even had a proposal.
We did.
We had a proposal, which was really cool. And the woman who was proposed to called, and we got her on with him, and it was all kinds of good stuff.
This kind of goes back to the days in a former life when I did Love Jones on the Once Big 89. And on
Jones.
Saturday nights, people would call in, and if they were out on a date and they had something they wanted to say to their date.
You know, we have to Love Jones next Saturday,
of course.
Yeah. Because that's one of those songs, it's an earwig. It gets in your
head.
By
the Brighter Side of Darkness.
I was just going to ask who did that, because I know the song.
A group from the south side of Chicago.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
I thought you knew that.
No, I did not.
Yeah.
I wonder if they're still alive.
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah. And then
Cheech and Chong did their parody.
Yes.
Basketball Jones. Yes.
That was a wonderful record.
The number of superstars on that recording is just phenomenal. I can't remember them all off the top of my head, but I'll have to wiki it, and it's amazing. I think like George Harrison is on there or something.
Yeah. And, Basketball Jones! Yeah, they got a Basketball Jones! Woo-wee!
It's a great song.
Julian is looking at us very strangely.
Oh, you got to hear it, Julian. It's a classic.
I love it. I'm a fan.
Oh, okay.
Of the Steve version, the Steve King version?
Of all the versions.
All versions. Okay.
Basketball Jones, back in my former life at the Once Big 89, that was on the top of the charts forever.
Do you believe that was 45 years ago?
Really?
Now Bob's going to tell us he was in grade school, right, Bob? Go ahead, tell me you're in grade school, because one of these days I'm just going to punch you. You were in grade school.
I was not. 45 years ago, I was not.
Where were you?
You're in high school?
Almost getting out of high school.
I knew it!
I couldn't believe that was 1981.
Okay, then I was out of high school. Okay. I was in college. Down in Champaign.
Much better.
Was that 81?
Yeah, I know.
No, because I remember playing it before that.
That was 73.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I certainly wasn't in college then.
Because
why does it say Wikipedia? Oh, okay.
My dad wasn't even born in 73.
Oh, hush.
Oh, stop it. Cut it out.
It was 73.
You may not live to see the end of the show, Julian, depending on how this conversation goes.
Go ahead and
goes.
Tell us how old your grandma was back in 73.
She was 15.
She was old. Oh, God! It was August of 73. That was a very good summer. That was the summer that I graduated from high school. Oh, and you're right. It was played constantly. It is a classic earwig. When it gets in your head, you got the basketball going over and over.
So we played a little bit of that tonight. Next week, we will have to play part of Love Jones by The Brighter Side of Darkness.
I'm quickly checking here. Do Cheech and Chong give Love Jones credit? I don't think they do.
Well, it was a parody song.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the parody rules were.
Yeah, it says here,
this is before sampling, and technically they didn't sample, but...
Yeah, that's true. They just kind of did a Weird Al version, take a song and then twist it up, and the song's opening lyrics.
I get it. Cheech and Chong, twist it. I get it. Yeah. Twist it up. I get it.
I scare myself sometime, you know? I really do.
She's really not medicated tonight, folks.
Hey. Depends upon what it is that you gave me before the show. Musicians who appeared on the record include George Harrison, Billy Preston, Tom Scott, Carole King. Oh, speaking of Carole King.
Yes.
Oh.
It. In fact, there were a couple shows. Stephen Colbert. You need to be watching Stephen Colbert.
If his politics make you crazy, come in after the monologue, okay?
He had a wonderful interview with James Taylor and performance by James Taylor. But James Taylor shared a really cool story about him and Carole King.
And the fact that Carole King had written You've Got a Friend. He heard the song. She had not recorded it. He was in the studio recording his album. And that song was just haunting him. So the band left and he sat down and recorded the song and went to her and said, I've recorded your song. Are you okay with that? And it was at that point she said to him, yes, you're the inspiration for the song.
Because after she heard his first album, with Fire and Rain, and she wrote this as kind of an answer to Fire and Rain, because they had been touring together for a while, and she did it because she wanted him to know that he had a friend.
And I thought, all these years, I never heard that story. And then he was performing with his son, which was wonderful.
Yeah.
And there was another 3 minutes that were classic television last week. Ian McKellen was on.
You have to watch Ian McKellen. Julian, you're nodding your head. Did you see the Ian McKellen bit?
That struck me on an emotional level.
Me too.
His monologue.
Us too.
His bit. And knowing that he originated that role.
Yeah.
Oh.
He did a Shakespeare piece
that he originated. And
60
I know it
years
sounds
before.
Weird. How could he? Trust me, he originated. Look it up on YouTube. You can find it. You need to watch it.
Brilliant.
It's wonderful.
It really, really is. And you were moved. It kind of freaked me out because I thought, why am I crying? It was just so beautiful.
We're sitting on opposite couches, and we both got teary.
Yeah.
It is a wonderful, wonderful bit.
What you want to look for is Ian McKellen's Shakespeare Colbert Show last week, and it will pop right up.
By the way, a little earlier, we posted on our Facebook page. People have been asking about the links to our blog and to our Blue Sky page, and we mention it, but if you haven't checked it out, we would appreciate it if you would check out both our blog, which is steveandjohnny.wordpress.com, and we'd love it if you would subscribe. There is no fee. We don't spam you. You just get an email anytime we do a new post.
And why are we asking that you join us over there? Things are changing on Facebook.
Yeah,
it seems
Facebook
like every
is becoming
week,
so wonky.
Yeah, there's something new. Tonight there was something new. I thought, well, why are you behaving this way? So we think that their day may come when we just decide, you know what, this is just too difficult. Yeah. So,
and also there's a link to our Blue Sky page, and that is, well, just go to our Facebook page, and you'll see the link, because it, to explain it, it's more cumbersome. Yeah. So just go to our Facebook page, and you will find a link to our Blue Sky page. I hear it. Okay.
Oh, my. Keeper, okay. The big plug, Bob is in here with...
He is right next to me, and he has...
a bunch of bowls.
He has bowls, and they have things that look as if they're cheesy things.
Crackery. Yes, if you're getting ready for Super Bowl Sunday, I said to Steve, what are we going to have? Because calories don't count when you're watching the Super Bowl, right?
Okay, so he has laid down, let me see.
You got your bowls? Yeah. I got bowls?
I'm looking here.
There's yours.
Okay.
No, is there an order?
He's got a stack of bowls here.
That's B.
He's got A, B, and C. Don't mix them up, Steve.
Oh, I don't know which is... I just took...
Yours is stacked.
The top, the middle.
Yeah, you just go one.
All right.
Okay.
Is Julian coming in here? Do we have enough for him?
I do.
Okay.
All right.
This is like communion. We get a little tiny cracker each.
you should... Okay.
There you go.
Okay, so there's three different... gluten-free cracker snacks.
Yes.
Julian, come get yours. All right. Yeah,
and we have to keep them in a specific order.
Yes.
Smell them.
I'm not even sniffing yet.
Some smell very cheesy. Ooh, very cheesy.
Okay, let me...
I don't think I mixed mine up. We've got triangles... Now, the story behind this gluten-free Cheez-It, which I think one of these looks like it's a Cheez-It because it's got that little hole in the middle of the square. It looks like Cheez-Its always look.
Actually, two of them have the hole in the middle of the square.
Yes.
One is kind of triangular.
Yeah.
And
but this has become a thing. If you follow any of the gluten-free Facebook pages or Reddit threads on this, it's crazy. People have gone goofy.
And understandably, because for all of the gluten-free things that have now become reasonably available, Cheez-Its have never been.
Yeah.
I mean, there have been things that attempted to emulate Cheez-Its, but they never really worked. But now... the word came out with, I think, within the past 2 months that, this is the real deal. Mm-hmm. Cheez-Its, gluten-free, and we all said, yay.
They just didn't make enough of them because people are hoarding the boxes of Cheez-Its. And,
now, what does it mean?
When Bob leaves us?
That Bob left us all with Cheez-Its and then he ran out of the studio. I have no idea where he's...
I think he...
What is
it? I just licked my finger with this kind of... It tastes like a very sharp cheese.
I think Mr. Brown's going to get into this, too.
Yeah. Okay, here we go.
I had to give Ron his.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Now, we're going to start with these triangles, right?
Yeah.
Should we get the blindfolds, blind taste test?
Okay.
So, all right, we're all in this together.
Triangles are for... Okay, first I'm going to sniff.
Yeah.
It's very cheesy. Ew. Ooh, I know.
Almost has a little pungent,
like
cheesy...
Socks.
Like a gorgonzola?
Yes.
Okay, so this is the triangle cheese.
Ooh.
Crunchy.
Mm.
That's good.
I like that.
Welcome to Cheesy ASMR with Steve and Johnny.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't like the aftertaste, though. How about you, Ron?
No, I'm fine with this. This is good. Mm. I want more of these.
It's not bad. Okay. It's not cheese it, but it is not bad.
One of the good things, if you've never had gluten-free foods, whether it is crackers, cookies, and some of the baked goods that I make, there's a crunch.
Yeah.
If you like crunch, you get a good crunch. Okay, I'm kind of like, this is a keeper.
Okay,
whose are these?
It's what, or do we want to go through all of them?
You
and then
go
you,
through all of them and I'll tell you who?
Okay, right. So number one, I would say it's not Cheez-It, but it's not
good.
Bad.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. I would buy these.
Okay, number
second
two.
Second one are the darker orange squares, and they also try to look like a Cheez-It because they've got the little dot in the middle.
Right.
But I can tell. I can tell just from picking them up.
Ooh.
Ick. They're a little thicker.
Ooh. Ew. Yeah,
that's a chore.
No.
Yeah, no.
No.
These are terrible.
Did you get these out of the dirt, Bob?
you'll be amused at the name of these.
I think these are dog treats. Yeah,
exactly. I was just going to say, I would pass
treats.
These on to the dog.
Oh, good, because there's two bags of them.
Ugh.
They came in pairs.
Jesus. Scooby Snacks or something?
Oh, they have a...
Oh, they're foul.
The brand name is on this one is Why.
That's well, a great question.
And that would be my question. Why?
Why? Why as in W-H-Y?
Yeah, exactly what it says. All right. Okay. See?
Okay.
Did you get doubles of that? I hope you didn't get doubles.
It came as two.
Did it really?
Yeah.
Okay, you leave them in the cafeteria.
Okay, here's the third one.
Okay. I have high hopes for this one.
They look like Cheez-Its.
These are good.
Big fan.
These are good?
Yeah, these are good.
I think I like the first one better.
I don't feel like I'm going to break my teeth on this one.
This is nice.
I don't know. The first one was Annie's.
Annie.
Yep.
Okay, we get a mac and cheese by Annie. A-N-N-I-E apostrophe S.
In a purple box.
Annie. Okay.
The second one was Y. And the third one was...
These are the real thing,
those
huh?
Those are the real
thing.
Wow.
See, I can tell these are the real thing because I can see myself, it's Saturday night. It's new comic book day. I have a bag of comics, I have a glass of milk, and a box of Cheez-Its. Yeah. I can see myself doing these with comics.
With
and
milk?
By the way, yes, with milk.
Yeah.
I know, that's his thing. Do you drink milk with food?
Yeah.
I mean, like meals.
Do you it's have never occurred to me to do it with Cheez-Its, though. It's interesting.
Oh, yeah. Because he has milk with all of his meals. Steak.
It is dairy, I guess.
Meatloaf.
Yeah.
Oh, whatever. These are good.
These are good.
These are really good.
You ever do milk with pizza?
Oh.
Yeah.
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 So
these kind of melt in your mouth.
Now, oh, wait Krista, a minute.
I was just going to say, what was Krista's
was nice
opinion?
Enough to give us her review. A. Taste the best. Smells
the triangles.
Good. Taste the best.
Okay.
That's A.
Annie's.
B. No.
Yep.
So answering the question
we're all
of
in
why.
Agreement on no. so on the, why,
the
no.
The product name is Y, no.
C. Pretty good. Smells like cat treats, but tastes good.
As I'm sitting here eating them.
Yeah.
So, I'm glad she didn't say tastes like cat treats.
No, she did. Yeah. She said it definitely does not taste like cat treats. It just smells like cat treats.
Well, who knows what cat treats taste like, though?
That's true.
Yeah. I don't.
Well,
so
I do.
She goes ACB. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think we agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I will stick with the Cheez-Its.
Really?
I would love to have someone who can eat gluten do a comparison with gluten-free Cheez-Its and gluten-free
I think
Cheez-Its.
If you put these out
for the team.
If you put them out at your Super Bowl party, nobody would know the difference. They would not know that these were not Cheez-Its.
Or you made up your, you know, your Chex Mix.
Yeah, right, exactly. Of course, now you need to take out a loan if you're going to have more than one person at your house, right,
That's
Bob?
That's true, yeah.
Because I just looked them up on Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, what are the prices of all three of these, starting with Annie's?
Annie's was like $5.
Okay.
And that's for
a small box.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And why?
Why?
Was also about $5, but you get two lovely pouches of why.
Yay! We get two pouches.
Okay. And then gluten-free Cheez-Its?
When I bought them, they were $14.95.
Wow.
I just looked them up, and they say, a deal, $13.88.
Oh, see, I bought too soon. Well,
2 weeks ago, I think when I first mentioned it on the air, and you came in and said, but there are other cheese crackers. I said, yeah, but they're not Cheez-Its. People were talking about going to Meijer's. I don't think Jewel had them yet, but these pages that I follow, and they were just literally taking cases of them, and then they were going over to eBay and selling them.
Of course.
Which is crazy.
Because it is that big a deal for the gluten-free community.
Yeah. I know, it's junk food, it's not the end of the world, but it's kind of, if you've got kids, you know, they may find that this is real normal. You know, you get a little bag of Cheez-Its like the rest of the kids have. It would be easy to confuse those with the real
good.
Thing.
They're
yeah,
good.
They're really good.
But I thought Annie was good. I thought Annie was the best.
But those whites,
yeah.
I know.
I might give those to my least favorite brother. That's what you get.
I want a brother so I can give them to him.
Give them to Lee. No, we like Lee.
We like Lee. We'll keep them. All right. We all agreed.
Yeah.
And Steve's craving a glass of cold milk. I can see it on your face right now. You want to stretch out with your milk on your tummy and your box of Cheez-Its in one hand.
And you know, I just thought I was trying to think of something earlier. And I told Johnny that, wait a minute, there's something I want to ask you about where we used to go after we did something, and I didn't remember what it was. I just remembered what it was.
What?
And it all, I will tie this tangled web together.
Please.
Cheez-Its, mm-hmm. comics. Mm-hmm. Earlier this week, it was the 40th anniversary of the publication of Frank Miller's Batman, The Dark Knight.
Yes.
And I can remember coming home, getting the first issue, and yes. Cheez-Its, milk, I'm good, Batman.
A whole box of Cheez-Its,
yeah.
too. And that was, of course, before you were diagnosed, so you probably felt like crap afterwards.
I did.
You blamed it on the comic book.
Yeah, the comic book.
This comic book put me in a mood.
Well, thank you, Bob, for for coming up with this taste test.
Krista said we should do this every week, just to taste different things. And I'm like, wait a minute.
Wait a minute. That's kind of expensive.
Well, now, is Dean Richards going to say we're encroaching on his food time?
Yeah, but he doesn't have gluten-free.
That's true.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's why I went gluten-free on this.
Good. I really appreciate that. We will pass the hat and give you money for those Cheez-Its. I think I have $2. Those $2 are yours, too.
Well, do you want me to go run and get you milk so you can have the rest of the Cheez-Its for the rest of the show?
Not now. Or
milk is not a good thing when you're on the radio.
No.
Unless you like a little...
Although, who was it? It was from the Small Potatoes.
Yes. Husband and wife.
Yeah, and this is awful. She's such a sweet person, and I can't think of her name.
Took her to the coffee machine. They were doing our show. They were performing on our show. She goes to the coffee machine and she says, oh, no, I just need a spot of coffee just to warm it up. I just need all the cream you've got. I went, whoa, what? She says, I like that deep guttural.
She wanted to get that phlegmy thing in her voice
when she was singing, and I thought, and
she sounds wonderful,
yeah,
but she's literally the only person I've ever heard say, I'm going to sing, I need more phlegm. What?
Okay. I had crackers working against me. All right, time for our shout outs,
and let me quickly dig up, because I have we had people who were checking in from all over the planet to our blog.
Mm-hmm.
And this week, and by the way, our blog is stephenjohnny.wordpress.com. We heard from the United States, from Singapore, Hong Kong, SAR, China, Netherlands, Germany, Poland, India, Ireland, the United Kingdom, and the Bahamas.
Wow.
So thank you for listening and for checking out our blogs.
And we have about 17 states that are tuned into the show tonight. You can text us all the time at 312-981-7200. And Gary did just that. He checked in at the top of the show from Arizona. Also, Dean is in Indy. And George, I mentioned him last time we were on the radio. George is a faithful listener every Saturday night. And he said, please say a little prayer for me. He's got a surgery coming up. So that's George. And George will be thinking about you. I missed you last week. Yes, I'm feeling better. Thank you for your nice wishes. Jim in Richmond is tuned in. He said, missed you last week. Glad your back is better. Scott is in Pierre, South Dakota. Sherry's in Bolingbrook. Stacy Drager is in Algonquin. Let's see here. Mankato, Minnesota. I believe this is the first time that they've checked in, and that's Lan Evanson in Mankato. Sherry and Bob are in Arlington Heights. Jean Jacobson's in Milwaukee. Diane Erickson is in Batavia. Judy Nyland is in Kenosha. Mike Fagel is in Akron, Ohio. Janice Kuratobi is in Norridge. Patrice Tintaros in Northwest Indiana. Bobby Danos is our buddy out in Sandwich. Dan and Debbie Scout are in Streamwood. Diane Vasquez is our graphics guru, and she put up a great one this week. Thank you, Diane. Don Perlman, you probably remember that name. Don put up a picture this morning under our brunch picture of our French toast and bacon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a picture of a T-shirt. I think we need this T-shirt. I can't make everyone happy. I'm not bacon.
Yeah.
I like that. I can't make everyone happy. Karen May is an Illini fan. I think maybe that's Karen Mary. She's an Illini fan. She's waiting for them to win. Louise Palish is in Norwood Park. Let me scroll through here. Jan Reinhart's in the laboratory. Chuck Snitchler is our buddy, best friend of this radio show on the station. He's in Valpo. Nancy Witt's in Milwaukee. Tracy Douglas is tuned in Savannah, where it's really chilly tonight. Also, Mark Goldstein is in Owings Mills, Maryland, which makes us think of John Davis from Motor Week, and we may be hearing from John next Saturday.
Yeah, next week, because we're going to be talking about the auto show, which starts
this weekend.
This weekend.
Yep. Lynn Kinzer just made me think of the picture I put up. I should put that up on our Stephen Johnny page. Back in the day when I was traffic reporter and I had a really cool shirt, which I still own. It's a shirt that has little tiny cars, real cars, sewn all over it. And it was adorable, but it was really hard to sit in because you're sitting leaning back on cars all over your back. But I'll put that picture up in honor of the auto show. Lynn Kinzer's in San Antonio,
Florida. In fact,
Florida.
If you go to our blog, you can see Johnny in that shirt.
Oh, yeah.
Along with a picture of me playing three guitars. And they're AI pictures.
Cartoons of us, yeah. Yes. Finish your crackers.
I am.
I can tell. John Couture is in Warren, Michigan. Peter Jukabowicz. Hi, Peter. He's in Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin, listening on his CC radio. Beverly Goodall is in Highwood. Terry Brock in Bridgeview. Joan Bloom in Greenville, South Carolina. Kristen Moberg is in McCoin, Wisconsin. Carrie Johnson's in Palm Coast, Florida. Nancy Holland's in Northbrook. Susie Schimmel's in Naples, Florida. Wow, Florida's really showing up tonight. Tom Murphy's in Lakeland, Florida. Sharon Malone's in Kenosha. Mary Cusworm is in Anna Maria Island, Florida. She's from Holmes Beach on Anna Maria Island. Mary Gold is in Tinley Park. Michelle Fairfield in Peoria. Debbie Hardiman is in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Margaret McCaslin is in Rochelle. Roy Phillips is listening on his smartphone. Brian Lefevre is in the beautiful city of Chicago in Bridgeport. Penny Schick is in Tavares, Florida. We've got about 10 cities in Florida tuned in tonight. Carrie Hunt is in Ruskin, Florida. A huge fan of Howard Levy. Looking forward to our conversation.
As are we.
Yeah. Judy Graham is in Plainfield. Renee Wish is listening on her AM radio. Helen Thomas is in Kenosha. Lloyd Moncrief is in Ottawa. Patty Ford, glad you kids are back. Karen Cochran is in Berwyn. Margot Moore in Albuquerque. Matt Palmer in Racine, Wisconsin. Judy B. in Oaklawn. Norm Rosansky, Sandy McCumas, Priscilla Gilbert Stagg, Scott Cooper, Carol Sachetti. And that's it.
And I have a couple more from our blog. Some people that contacted us today. Debbie Tusick said, I will be listening from Sandwich on my phone.
Hey, Debbie.
Hope your back is better. Then somebody, I don't know who this is, but their email is super be casually. says, sounds like a great show. Gene Jacobson said, glad Johnny is better. I'll be listening from Milwaukee on my Sea Crane transistor radio with their pillow earphones.
Mm-hmm.
And Patty from Pennsylvania says, happy you found some relief to keep us smiling and, of course, in great company. We'll be listening on my tablet while snowbirding in Myrtle.
Myrtle Beach. JP from Peoria is listening to the 50,000-watt love pump, as he says. He's been around for a while, if he calls us that. Gail Wren is in Roscoe, and Mike is in Elmwood Park. And if I missed you, I'll catch you next week, because we've got full shows for the whole month of February.
Yeah. This is the first month we've had a month of full shows.
This is true. Yeah. Oh, by the way, I did post some pictures on our trip into work tonight and some fun shots of the city. And
the city was clear tonight, so we got some really nice clear pictures, too.
By the way, Pure Michigan just checked in. Now, Brian Union is listening from Pure Michigan. And as I said, you can check in with us throughout the show at 312-981-7200.
It has been way too long since we've had the chance to catch up with one of the most talented human beings in the universe. He does things with a harmonica that no human being should be able to do.
And now he's an author on top of all of the other things that he does musically, including being a band leader and a producer and a teacher. He's the author of a wonderful new book entitled I Speak Music, Stories from My Improbable Life. He is the one and only Howard Levy. Howard, hi.
Hey, Howard.
Hey, so nice to hang out with you guys again.
Hey, I got to tell you from the outset, there's never been a more appropriate title for a book. I Speak Music. That is you, Howard.
And Howard, I have to share with you a little behind the scenes things. For Christmas, I got Johnny two books. One was the brand new book by Michelle Obama.
Right.
The other was your book. And
thank you for autographing it, by the way.
And normally, as we're going to interview someone, usually we will kind of skim through the book. I'll be very candid with you. We have not finished your book because we're savoring it. This is a wonderful book, Howard.
Thank you so much.
There's so many questions I have because we have interviewed you for hours over the years. It's just been too long since we've had that opportunity. But as I'm reading the book, I thought, I never knew that. Oh, my gosh. Your recall of events is wonderful, Howard. How long did it take you to get the whole concept of the book together, the memoir of your improbable life?
Well, that's a really good question. I think I started thinking about really doing something like this, putting all these stories that were knocking around in my head, probably during COVID, when I couldn't play gigs, you know?
Yeah.
And I was working on various different projects, but I had some of the stories written before as more like diary entries, you know, rather than stories that I would want to tell to other people. And so I started getting, you know, thinking more and more about the whole scope of my life and realized, boy, there's a lot of stories. And I started writing them. And then I started to try to polish them. When it became clear that it was actually going to turn into a book, I realized, well, I have to really try to make the reader feel like they're there with me, you know, and make them more vivid because I was there. So I know all these details, but the longer I sat and really thought about it as I was reading it, more and more details came back to me. It was almost like watching movies.
And Howard, I have to share with you, this is one of those wonderful books that you can open to any chapter and immediately you're drawn in. I never knew that you were such a really good writer. You're terrific.
Oh, thank you. You know, it's something I've always messed with, but to put yourself out as a writer, it requires more than messing with it. You have to polish it. And so I, you know, in my mind, I was going back to stuff that I had learned in high school about writing, you know, and really, really trying to present it as a finished product, because, you know, it's one thing to tell people stories. It's another thing to write them down in a vivid way that, that readers can get the full depth and breadth of what you're trying to talk about. You know?
And you suck them in. You want to hear more about what happened when Howard went to that gig. And you give such great detail. And forgive me for saying this, but it crossed my mind a couple of times when I was reading a couple of the 88 stories that you have in the book. And I thought, this man
By the way, I will interject, 88 stories, and there are 88 keys on a piano. Strictly coincidence, right, Howard?
Strictly coincidence. Of course you would know that, but no, it is absolutely coincidence.
No,
you're kidding.
No, there were many more stories, and we're looking at this thing like, this book is going to be 600 pages long. I cannot have all of these things in here. So, yeah, let's cut this one. And then it turned out to be 88. I went, wow, that's the perfect number. I don't want to mess with it anymore.
Yeah.
No more, no less.
Very cool.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
So my point was, as I'm reading some of these stories and I'm pulled in with the intricate detail down to the weather, the traffic, you know, I think Howard has lived a very clean life because he remembers all of this.
Yeah.
You grew up in the 60s, yet you remember what happened to you in the 60s, in the 70s, and the 80s.
Oh yeah. You know, it's kind of weird that, you know, time is kind of an illusion. Like, we're in the present, but if we want to put ourselves back, it's sort of like the way people meditate and get into an altered state. I can put myself back into any time of my life if I really try. Wow. And if I'm stimulated the right way, you know, like, or if I'm with a person mm-hmm. that I shared an adventure with like 20 or 30 years before that I had not, I'd never thought about it. But when I'm with that person, suddenly I remember the whole thing.
And I bet you music does that to you too, that you'll hear a couple of notes of a song and boom, it just brings back when you first heard it. And, you know, what were the particulars around that song and why does it stick in your memory?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Just before we take a break, if you don't mind, I'd like you to tease with a story that one of many stories I'm blown away by. As you're doing a recording session with Jack Bruce and you're trying to help him tune up, can you explain that? What a wonderful story.
Oh, well, that was really a trip because I had seen Cream on their first American tour when I was in high school in New York. And so I was, when years later, I don't remember how many years later it was, let's see, like 10 years later or 15 years later, I don't know. But to find out that I'm actually going to record with Jack Bruce, I was really thrilled. It was a little studio on Southport called Acme, run by a guy named Mike Rasfeld. And he did a lot of very good recordings in there. He passed away in the mid-80s, late-80s, I can't remember. But so this was early 80s, I think. Mm-hmm. And so I walked in the studio all excited that I was going to be recording with Jack, was with this woman, killer singer, slide guitarist named Ellen McElwain. And Paul Wertico was playing drums. And Ellen played piano, but not well enough for her own recording. She was a killer guitar player. So they hired me. And here's Jack sitting there. And, you know, what am I going to say to one of my heroes, you know, besides hi, you know? And so we're ready to play, and like, hey, you want an A? No. You want a G? You know, no. You want a D? Those are the three of the open strings on a bass, you know, the three that most bass players, one of those would be, you know, one of the notes that you'd play, or even a chord, you know, something. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting there going, am I going to be an asshole and say, and ask, and how he's tuning his bass. It's like, well, do you have perfect pitch? He says, no. And I said, okay, well, now I really have to ask him how he's tuning his bass. And so he looks up at me, takes the headphones off, and says, you know, those years when I was playing with Cream, we were filling really large venues with these Marshall stacks, and we were so loud that I have a permanent G above middle C ringing in my ears at all times, and I tune my bass to it.
Unbelievable.
And so.
And you knew he was serious. You knew that was legit.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
I said, oh, man, I'm so sorry. What a drag. He said, yeah, it's a drag, but as soon as I start playing, I just tune it out and forget about it.
Amazing.
But back then. Yeah, there were no, but like monitors and PAs were just sort of cobbled together. You know, it wasn't sophisticated in the late 60s. So people were filling rooms with these giant amps, you know?
Yeah.
There is an extraordinary book. It is called I Speak Music. And the blatant plug light just went on. And so I'm going to say, forget about Amazon. Jeff Bezos has enough money. Go to Howard's website, levyland.com. Get the book there. It is a wonderful, wonderful book. It belongs in your collection.
So, Howard, it all started in New York as a kid.
That's right.
That's where you were born and raised. And you were a pianist, right? That's how it all started, musically, on piano.
Yeah, I started taking piano lessons when I was 8 years old. And I started improvising after the third lesson. And it was one of those things that I guess I was storing it up, you know. I went to the Manhattan School of Music on Saturdays for 4 years, studying classical piano and theory. But I always improvised. And so that, you know, that kind of that stayed with me for my whole life, really. I started forming bands. My first band, I actually wrote a story about it in the book called The Offbeats, where we played one song for the spring assembly when I was in sixth grade, because that's what schools in New York at the time, elementary school, sixth grade was when you got out, you know. And it was such a hit with the kids, and all these people are giving me very admiring. A lot of the pretty girls are giving me very admiring glances who never would have looked at me otherwise. Uh-huh. And I thought, well, maybe there's something to this being a band leader thing. So,
in sixth grade.
So, in sixth grade, that's where it started. And, you know, when I was in high school, I formed a band with a bunch of friends of mine. We used to play high school dances. You know, I had a Farfisa organ, and I played a very long solos on Light by Fire, you know. And it meant we didn't have to learn a few more tunes. It was, you know, take that 10-minute organ solo, Howard, you know.
You're known as flat out the master of the diatonic harmonica. So how did you first get your hands on a harmonica? I mean, you go from piano to harmonica, night and day.
Well, yeah. Well, what happened was one of the guys in the band, who was the drummer, was a super talented musician. He was a very good classical violinist, and he taught himself drums by emulating Elvin Jones. I mean, he didn't start with somebody easy, you know? And then we, in the band, we started getting into blues and going out and hearing great blues groups from Chicago. Mm-hmm. Paul Butterfield, James Cotton. I heard a double bill of them one night, and that blew my mind. And my friend had started playing harmonica, and he started sounding really good. And I thought, well, man, I'd love to be able to bend notes and carry an instrument in my pocket, and not so I wouldn't have to go to a piano whenever I wanted to play something. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Manny's. Remember Manny's on 48th Street in New York?
Okay.
It was the music store.
Right.
It was the music store in New York. And I went in there and I went, I want to buy a harmonica. What key should I get? And the guy behind the counter said, why don't you get a G? It's lower. It has a richer sound. I said, fine. You know, so there's a marine band and a blues harp. I can't remember. I think I bought the marine band, and it cost $2.25.
Wow.
And I called my friend up on the phone. I said, hey, I want you to give me a lesson. Show me how you play all those blues licks. Well, make the story short, he couldn't show me because it's inside his mouth. It's like showing someone how to ride a bicycle. It doesn't work, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so when I started sounding good was the first week that I was at Northwestern. This was the senior year of high school when I bought the harmonica.
Mm-hmm.
So first week at Northwestern, I went to a rally for the Chicago Seven.
Oh.
And they let them out of jail to make fundraising speeches and appearances to pay for their defense.
Mm-hmm.
And there were about 500 of us crowded into this lecture hall at Northwestern, and it was kind of mind-blowing. And I had never been west of Pennsylvania before in my life. And there I am, you know, I don't know a soul, and I just heard all these guys, Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin and Rennie Davis and all these people. My head was spinning, like, what do I do with myself, you know? So I'm walking down the path. I said, why don't I try playing the harmonica again? So I took the G harp out of my pocket that I had bought at Manny's, and suddenly I was able to bend notes and play all these blues licks. It happened like in a blink of an eye.
Wow.
Like, it happened by itself. I don't understand it to this day, but I guess I was ready for it.
Yeah.
And it was like the first day of the rest of my life.
But how did you ultimately wind up zeroing in on piano and harmonica? Because over the course of your career, you played bass, you played guitar, you played mandolin, you basically name it, and you have played it. What was the point in your career when you kind of zeroed in and say, okay, I'm going to pretty much focus on these two?
Well, I actually have some stories about that.
Yeah.
And it's what happened is, within a few months of playing the harmonica, I got frustrated that I could only just play blues licks and they were missing notes. And so I figured out how to get the missing notes, which I called overblows and overdraws. And I was able to play a full 3-octave chromatic scale on a diatonic harmonica, which nobody had ever done before. And there I was, an 18-year-old college student. I just thought, this is really crazy. I mean, it's very exciting, but it's kind of crazy because I've never heard anyone else do this before. So I started getting really good at it. And then when that happened, I thought, well, maybe I could play other instruments too. And John Coltrane was like my god, okay? Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I want to learn how to play the tenor sax. And so I borrowed a saxophone from a friend there. And that was kind of the beginning of my multi-instrumental phase. And there's a story in the book that where I go into it in great detail. Mm-hmm. It's called My Allies, My Instruments. Mm-hmm. Because each instrument I played really changed my personality.
Yeah.
Playing the harmonica for a guy who just pushed keys up and down on a piano, like suddenly breathing through an instrument, like breathing life into it, it changed my whole perspective on what is expression. And, you know, it just made me feel totally different. And every instrument I picked up did that for me.
And we're sitting here. I have to tell you, though, we're sitting here smiling because that's the way your mind works.
Yeah.
When you just say, it changed me forever. And that's what comes through in the stories that you tell. And I love that series of where you talk about playing the mandolin, you talk about playing various horns and such.
How did you figure out that you could play on harmonica and at the same time not overdubbed mm-hmm. on piano, Howard?
Well, that's a great question. A lot of harmonica players, you watch us play, and most of the time our eyes are closed.
Yes.
If you watch guys, you know, and because we can't see the instrument, right? I mean, it's the only instrument I know of that the person who's playing it has absolutely no visual contact with, and there's no hands, there's no fingering either,
right.
A diatonic harmonica anyway. So, you know, my eyes are closed, and for the first few years I was playing, I'm seeing shapes and colors, but after a while I said, I'm seeing something else, and I realized what I was seeing was the piano keyboard. Because that's my frame of reference to music. Anyone who plays piano, if you play a tune like that, our hands will play an invisible keyboard in the air. We'll play mm-hmm. air piano, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so after a while, I thought, well, maybe I could actually play piano and harmonica at the same time. And it's because I bought that G harmonica at Manny's that
it was magic.
That was the key harmonica that I see as a piano keyboard. It's just like a direct one-to-one thing. So usually when you see me playing piano and harmonica at the same time, it's with the G harmonica.
The very first time you told that story, it was about 2:00 in the morning.
Yep.
And I thought my head was going to explode. We're on the radio and you just casually tossed that off and I went, oh, my Lord.
and if I'm not wrong, I think that was the same night that you started telling us something about the number 7. And I got so confused and your mind was going in all of these crazy places.
It was wonderful. Oh. Yeah, we just stand back in awe. Yeah.
I got cosmic with you guys that night.
You did. I'll never forget. You just come from a show that you'd done downtown, and you just wandered into the studio over at the Tribune Tower, and it was in the middle of the night.
By the way, we've never done this with the guests, but can we book you again? And I'll tell you why. As I said at the outset, we're savoring this book. We haven't finished it. We would like to get you back on in studio, say maybe 6 months from now, when we have finished the book and do a little face-to-face decompression on everything that we've been absorbing from your book.
Wow. Oh, well, of course.
Let's do it.
Unless I might have a bar mitzvah to play that day. No, if I'm around, I would love to. Yeah.
Well, speaking absolutely. Of it, if you're around, you have some gigs coming up in the Chicago area over the next few weeks, months, whatever, right?
Yeah, I have a few small ones, but the biggest one is at Elmhurst University on April 7th. I'm going to be doing a concert with the Elmhurst University Big Band, led by a fantastic trumpet player named Kirk Garrison. And we're going to do some of my original pieces. I composed a 3-part suite for harmonica and big band, co-arranged by a wonderful arranger named Scott Rautenberg. And we're going to do those pieces as well as probably do the Prelude to a Kiss, the famous Strayhorn Ellington tune that I actually performed with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. About 30 years ago, led by his son Mercer. And that was a dream. I was floating on air after that. So we'll do those tunes and a number of others. Very much looking forward to that. And also Chris Siebold will be playing some duo stuff with me in that concert, because Chris is also a guitar instructor at Elmhurst. Mm-hmm. And we have an album called, God, what's it called? I haven't thought about it in so long. Ah, what's it called? Oh, my God. Well, it's Howard Levy and Chris Siebold. And it's called, oh, God. You know, I put out so many albums that I forgot the name of it.
And you were talking about this great memory recall that you have.
Yeah.
And you know what's
weird? It's all a fraud. You know
what's weird? We have that album too, yes. And we bought it up at Guitar Works one night when we were up there, and Guitar Works in Evanston, and Chris was up there, and we were talking with him, and we bought the album. So we can't think of the title of it either.
Yes.
But yeah. There's an album with both of them.
In fact,
yes,
Howard.
Oh, yes, of course. Art plus Adrenaline. How could I forget it? Yes.
How could you forget it? How many albums? You have your own music that you have done solo, that you've done with Siebold, that you've done with various bands. Do you know how many hundreds of albums you have been on?
I've lost track. It's somewhere between, somewhere around 400 probably.
Easily.
I really don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because I have a partial discography on my website,
mm-hmm.
And I have about 20 under my own name,
mm-hmm.
including my my classical album that has my harmonica concerto on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I composed another concerto.
Well, of course.
Yeah, that took a tremendous amount of time, and I really, didn't play any. I tried to play as few gigs as possible. And it took me, I'd say the better part of a year, and
really?
Actually longer.
Wow.
It's called, the name is as long as it took me to write it. It's called Eastern European Harmonica Concerto for Single Soloists. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Eastern European Harmonica and Piano Concerto for Single Soloists. Because I'm the soloist on both instruments. So, I couldn't call it a harmonica and piano concerto, because people would think that there were two musicians playing.
Mm-hmm.
But I play harmonica, piano, and then in one movement I play them together. And it's over a half hour long for full orchestra. And it's heavily based on Eastern European music, like Bulgarian music, Macedonian music, Greek music. Almost all of it is in odd time meters.
Hmm.
And I am thrilled that I got a chance to compose it. And it's going to premiere in the fall with an orchestra in Florida called the Symphonia Gulf Coast.
Hmm.
And they're a very good orchestra in Destin, Florida, which I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
In fact, Destin is a hop, skip, and a jump down from our little yellow house in Panama City Beach.
Yeah.
We'll have to see if we could be down there at the same time you're going to be down there.
It would be wonderful. Yeah, it was supposed to be scheduled for last year, but something intervened and got postponed until this year. So.
I have an odd question. When you're working on a concerto, how similar, if at all, is that to the process that a lot of people do when they're working on a popular song? And where I'm going with this is, I've talked to a lot of composers who said, I've been working on this, but then I needed to get away from it for a while to get some space, and then I come back to it. Is that the same thing when you're working on a classical piece, or do you need to just immerse yourself into it?
I would say it's both. There's an amazing subconscious connection that goes on inside the mind to tie together all the themes of a piece, and it's something that I really don't understand consciously, because my first concerto, I didn't realize it until after I heard a recording of it, how unified the various different melodies were, and how they were sort of parts of each other. And I still don't use a computer to write. I compose with a pencil and a piece of paper.
Good for
you.
Yeah.
And this one, I gave it to somebody to put it into computer music notation,
mm-hmm.
which did help. I mean, and when he sent me back the files, they did have the sound files too, so I'm sure I caught a few mistakes that I would not have caught otherwise. Mm. But, I sit at the piano and I imagine the sound of all the instruments, because I know how they sound,
mm-hmm.
and I know a lot about a lot of instruments, as you can tell from my book. so a lot of them are things that I can actually play. So when I'm writing flute parts and oboe parts and clarinet parts and stuff like that, I know how to play those instruments. And I know the ranges of all the string instruments because I play the mandolin, and I've played with a fantastic cellist named Eugene Friesen for years as part of Trio Globo. So I have a between all the string players I've played with, and I have a real good understanding of string instruments and percussion too. And, you know, so it's very exciting for me to put together the orchestration. But sometimes, yeah, I do need to step away. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just feel like you're hitting your head against the wall, and you might go down some sort of dead end, you know, a blind alley, and you realize, mm-hmm. God, this isn't going anywhere. I don't like this last 16 bars. Tear the page out, throw it in the garbage, and go back to the good stuff mm-hmm. and work from there. So it's sort of everything, really. I mean, it's sort of all-consuming, too. And you get possessed by it,
yeah.
Which is the same way that I felt about writing this book. The stories in the book, they were like, it was sort of haunting me.
Yeah, they wanted to be told. They were waiting to be out there.
And in a weird way, like writing the book means I don't have to think about the stuff anymore. Because I got it off my chest.
You declutter that crazy mind of yours. That's amazing.
Exactly.
And Howard, we were talking about you composing music, and in the book, one of your 88 stories is, you call it the high point of your theater experience, when you were asked to compose music for a play. Now, this takes us back to the mid-80s. This was a play that was going to be staged at the Organic Theater, right?
Yes. Puntula and His Hired Man, it was called, by Bertolt Brecht.
Mm-hmm.
And it was it apparently had never been performed in the United States before. It's possible that it was, but I don't think it ever was. And so it was something that the director, the late Larry Sloan, contacted me, and they wanted a score that was more modern, because the original score was like German expressionist, highly dissonant, weird stuff from the 1920s or whatever, when Brecht was in Berlin. And he said, you know, I don't think this music is going to fly in Chicago. And he didn't want it to be like that. He said he wanted a more modern sounding mm-hmm. score that reflected Chicago a little bit. And so they gave me this script, and I sat around and stared at it. I go, my God, I don't know where to begin.
Now, did they was it already cast with Bill Peterson and Amy Morton and Bonnie Kolak? Did you know who the actors were?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a little hard for me to remember. Mm-hmm. I think that Bonnie Kolak was cast. And I guess, Bill and Amy, I guess they were all in the cast at that time. Mm-hmm. And Denny Arndt, who I had not met yet, who was an amazing actor, and he's actually appeared in quite a few movies in sort of secondary lead roles. But, I sat and stared at it, and I'm going, God, like, I don't know. It could be this, it could be that. I had done music for some, like, documentary films and all sorts of stuff like that, and written a few things for plays that were real obscure earlier in my life. But this is kind of a big deal, and one day, suddenly, the first melody came to me, and in short succession, almost all the other ones, within about 2 or 3 hours, I wrote all of it, like 15 songs, something crazy like that.
Yeah.
It just sort of came over me, and I had learned by that time to trust my instincts. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like the first thing that you think of sometimes is the best thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a creative person and you actually feel some sort of simpatico with the lyrics, then, like, odds are what you write is not going to be too terrible. So I made a very crude recording onto a cassette machine of uh-huh. me singing this stuff, playing piano, and I brought it up to Larry in his office. I was really nervous, you know. They had mm-hmm. promised me all this money, and he said, I love it. Mm. It's great. I went, you do? It's like, okay, well, I guess we're on, you know. So that was an incredible adventure, and I was at every rehearsal.
I want to take you, to that moment that you write about in the book where you're stage left, you're in the dark, you're playing piano. It's a very emotional, very dramatic scene with Bill Peterson and Amy Morton, and you realize that a door has opened, right?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
The door opened, and then you realize there's a figure coming through that door.
Oh, this was... Only in live theater would stuff like this happen. It's like a Mel Brooks movie.
Yeah.
It was the one time in the show where I wasn't playing any music and I was in the dark because I was on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing about 11 instruments and, you know, I underscored the whole thing even when it wasn't a song. It was like a movie soundtrack, you know?
Right.
And I won the Jeff Award that year for it, too.
Mm-hmm.
The Joseph Jefferson Award for Best Incidental Music for a Play, which was a thrill to win that award. But I'm hearing this noise, and I look up, and there's this old woman with a cane, and she's walking down the stairs toward the stage. And some people in the audience, they're starting to laugh a little. They think, well, maybe this is one of the characters from the play who's answering from the audience. I mean, they didn't know what it was.
Right.
And I'm there in the dark, and she starts walking onto the stage. And I thought, if I walk out onto the stage and grab her, I'm calling attention to myself. And no one's going to pay any attention to Amy or Bill, who are in the middle of, like, the heaviest scene in the whole play.
Oh, my
God.
And
I'm just hoping that an usher is going to be there. Someone has to see this and go onto the stage and grab her. No one did. And she starts walking across the stage. And there's, of course, a door that's part of the set. And she's looking for the bathroom. And she starts opening the doorknob. And at this point, Bill just like loses it. Like drool is coming out of his mouth. And Bill and Amy are just laughing hysterically. The whole audience bursts into laughter. Someone finally runs on the stage and gently escorts this woman off the stage into the lobby where the actual bathrooms are. And we could not stop laughing for about 3 minutes. They tried starting the scene again several times, and it was like one of those blooper reels you see at Seinfeld or something. And they finally got it together and kept going with the play.
Unforgettable. Live theater. That, I love that story. Thank you for sharing that. As I said, that's one of the 88 stories. If you love music, if you are a musician, if you just like a slice of life, he gives you almost 70 years worth of life here in the book.
If you could care less about music, this is a wonderful book. If you love the story you just heard, this book is full of gems like that. It is a wonderful book. And again, don't give Jeff Bezos more money. Don't go to Amazon. Go to levyland.com.
Right.
And that's where I ordered the book.
I Speak Music, Stories from My Improbable Life. You've done good, Howard. You really, I think you got to be mighty proud, but you got to step back and say, I really did this. I narrowed it down to 88 stories. And let me see how many pages. Well over 400 pages.
450, I think, something like that.
Yeah, you did really well.
And as we're going through this, I want to read the ones that made it to the cutting room floor. I want volume two.
Yes.
Oh, there's some good ones, but I don't think there'll ever be a volume two. I've been through it. I put myself through enough grief while writing this. But, it's really... You know, the scope of the stories, once I realized it, it's like, how am I going to organize this thing? Because it can't really be sequential.
Right.
Like, and so I just sort of split it up into these chapters. And one of my favorite chapters actually is the one that's, it's called In Good Company.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I deal with the more well-known people that I played with.
Yes, and so many of them.
I had long working relationships with, some of them. John Prine and Bonnie Kolak and Ken Nordine and Kenny Loggins, who I toured with for a few years.
Yeah.
And Donald Fagen, who I just think is an absolute genius. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's about as great of a musical talent as I think there is.
Yeah.
Well, Howard, we are only going to let you go. Again, as I said earlier, if you promise you're going to come back in a few months, so whenever it works out with your schedule and ours, we want to get you in the studio. Johnny will make some homemade brownies.
Yes, we'll have a good time.
Okay, I'm there.
Okay. All right. And folks can see you on April 17th at Elmhurst University with the big band, and they can get April, all... Excuse me, April 7th.
April 7th.
Yes, I saw my one there.
That's
April
why we
7th.
Have two checkbooks.
And that's only our anniversary. you think I would remember that. It's our wedding anniversary, but yes.
Oh.
Again, congratulations, Howard, and thank you so much for staying up tonight and joining us. We really appreciate
it. Blast to be with you guys again.
Take care.
Thanks
talk
so
to you
much,
soon.
Howard. Again, the book is that good. It really, really is.
You'll laugh out loud. There are times, and then sometimes you'll just step back and go, oh my gosh, how does one's mind work like that?
Well, again, levyland.com to get the book. Okay. Another friend that we haven't talked with in a long time, John Mueller. We first met John years ago when we saw him portraying Buddy Holly in the Buddy Holly story.
Who joins us tonight after a gig in Ohio. Hi, John Mueller.
Hi, Steve and Johnny. It's great to hear your voices again.
Oh, it's so nice to talk to you. You are traveling with the Winter Dance Party. Your show is in Marion, Ohio tonight. Is that right?
Yes, a beautiful old vaudeville theater called the Marion Palace Theater. Just a beautiful theater.
The Winter Dance Party, for anybody who knows anything about music, in the past week we all found ourselves reminiscing, especially on Facebook, about the fact that it was the anniversary of the concert
Day the Music Died.
Yeah. As we say, the day the music died. And how long have you been doing the Winter Dance Party, John? Because that was 25 years ago you did the Hey Buddy song in our studio.
And that's when we first saw you, when you were portraying Buddy Holly in the play.
Yeah, I think that was 97 in Chicago. And I started the tour in 1999, so that's 27 years. Isn't that
crazy?
Oh my gosh, I can't believe it. I can't believe it.
Now, your Winter Dance Party concert, which features you performing the music of Buddy Holly and Richie Valens and the Big Bopper, this is the official show, right? This is the one that got the nod from the families of Holly and Valens and the Big Bopper.
Yes, correct. In fact, we even had Buddy's widow, Maria Elena Holly, join us on a few tours. I couldn't believe she would be up for that, going to the frozen tundra Midwest, but she was really game, and it was fun.
After all these years, you're still able to bring a fresh quality to your performances, and that's a tribute to your ability and also to the music of Buddy Holly.
Oh, thanks, Steve. We try real hard to make it as fun as possible for the audience. And I think part of that has come from just mixing up the catalog of songs that we do. Sometimes we call some improvisation on stage. We'll just like, hey, I want to do Blue Days, Black Nights tonight. And that's always fun for me and the audience, I think, because they feel like they're watching something that just happens spontaneously. And I think that's a key element in rock and roll. It's kind of spontaneous music, you know?
Yeah. So are you ever surprised when you look out in the audience and you see that you're playing to these full houses? People want to hear this music, but then there are young people in the audience that they're craving an opportunity to hear this music live, too. Does that ever surprise you?
Yeah, it does sometimes, especially when they're really young. We had a young man about 12 years old the other night, and he said he was a huge Buddy Holly fan, and he's learning to play guitar, and he just loved the show. And I was like, how did you even know about this or get into it? And he said, my parents kind of play this music, and my grandparents played it. And, he just was really into it. That really tickles my heart when that happens, for sure.
Sure.
You have... we're getting a lot of texts from some people who would like to know where the heck you're going to be when you're in the Chicago area. So what areas around Chicago are you going to be playing in the not-too-distant future?
Yeah, I think on February 20th, we're at the Rao Center for the Arts, which is in
Crystal Lake,
Illinois.
Yeah. Hey, but wait a minute. I know we do have a lot of listeners in Indiana. You're in Shipshewana the night before. On the 19th.
Yes, Shipshewana, Indiana, the night before at the Blue Gate Theater, which is a fun place, too. And after the Rouse Center, I think we're in Carthage, Illinois, at the Legacy Theater.
Mm-hmm. So this keeps you busy this time of the year, winter of all things, right?
Yeah.
As in the winter dance party. But you've been incredibly busy as a solo musician and, in fact, been working on a new album, right?
Yeah, really exciting. I just met this guy on a plane one time. I was flying back from a show in Arizona, and this guy came on. He looked like he was a member of the, like a 70s country band or something, you know, long hair. And and turns out he was a musician / producer. He's Shooter Jennings' bass player.
Oh.
Shooter Jennings, of course, is Waylon Jennings' son.
Yeah.
Sure.
So we started talking, and I said, you know, I'm working on some new songs and stuff. He goes, well, that's what I do. I produce a lot of independent artists in Los Angeles. And I was like, you're kidding. So he sent me his link to his, you know, stuff he'd done and stuff. And I was really impressed. And he's been a great contact for me. Just his name's Ted Russell Camp. And he's just a great guy. And he's been really, like, you know, when you find, like, when Buddy found Norman Petty, like somebody that understands the creative process that you like and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just feels like a good fit for me. So I've been really happy with working with it.
And how weird that here's the guy that works with Shooter Jennings, Waylon Jennings' son, and Waylon Jennings has history with the Winter Dance Party.
Yeah, we have a little tie-in there.
Yeah.
Waylon Jennings was the bass player for Buddy on the Winter Dance Party tour. Was actually supposed to get on the plane, but I guess he decided to give his ticket to the big bopper who was sick with the flu, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I know we've told you this story when we had Waylon Jennings on the show. He told us about the time he was on his bus as a country performer. And
he had just finished the show and he got on his bus and he was sitting there by himself. And all of a sudden the door opens. And this big guy gets on, and he walks back down the bus to him, and he says, the big bopper was my dad. Can you tell me about my father?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an awesome story. Jay Richardson Jr., sure.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember the first time we ever saw Shooter Jennings was on Waylon Jennings' bus. It was at a concert around Joliet, Illinois,
mm-hmm.
and it was the Highwaymen with the Waylon and Willie and Johnny Cash, and Waylon invited us back on his bus, and there was this little tiny Shooter Jennings.
He was homeschooled. Yeah. He was doing his homework.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
John was nice enough to send us a copy of his brand new song that we love. It's called VW Bus.
You're talking about writing that song and working on the album. What are your goals this year for the album? What are you hoping to, when do you hope to have it in your hands?
I'm going to hope this spring by April to have it done. Yeah, I've already got about 9 songs done, and just I want to get another 2 or 3
Mm-hmm.
Recorded, and then I should be able to do that by the next 3 months or so, and then get it manufactured and all that good stuff and released on streaming platforms and all that.
As you're traveling with the Winter Dance Party, are you able to write, or you're just focusing on the shows as you're doing them?
Mostly just focusing on the shows, because it gets pretty exhausting. Like, you just come back to the hotel room and you just want to I just don't feel like I'm in a writing mood then.
Yeah, yeah.
But I when I get home, some downtime, I tend to get up in the morning and just start messing around with the guitar and stuff, and coming up with some ideas and stuff, and then play around with some lyrics and stuff. And then something always comes. I'm finding my best songs come from personal experience, so I'm trying to steer more in that direction.
It is definitely one of anybody who ever traveled with their folks back in the day when you had a limited amount of time and you get in the back seat of the car and you probably didn't have air conditioning. In your case, it was in the VW bus. That was a slice of life. What is home for you these days, John?
I'm still living in Los Angeles, the Sherman Oaks area.
Oh.
And, yeah. And
where it's been like in the 90s. in December and January. It's crazy.
<I'm not there. laughs>
We have family in LA, and they're like, we're running around in shorts, and you people are still digging out of the snow. And you, John, you're traveling with the concert and going to the coldest places in Pennsylvania and Iowa.
I know. It's been a cold trip, this one. It's been an action-packed trip. We started out at the Valor Ballroom in Des Moines, Iowa. We played the Surf Ballroom on the actual anniversary night, February 2nd, that the original tour did. And we also were part of a big ribbon-cutting ceremony there where they opened the Grammy Museum there.
Mm-hmm. Who's in the band now? Who's Richie Valens in the Big Bopper?
The Richie Valens has pretty much been the same guy as always. His name's Ray Anthony.
Really?
Oh, sure. Yeah, Ray was in the studio with us several years ago.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And then Linwood Sasser replaced Jay Richardson when he passed in 2013. So he's been with us since 2013. He's been really great. He's a super nice guy and really energetic on stage and stuff. And and the band is. I think only the drummer's changed and the saxophone player. Everybody else is pretty much the same. And they're really great. It's a great group of guys. And it's kind of my secret weapon. If I didn't have them, I wouldn't be as good as the show is.
You love the music and you do such a great job of it. But at some point, do you say to yourself, why the heck am I going out on the road in the middle of winter?
Yeah.
We make this a summer dance party.
Yeah, the guys always joke, I could have been the Hawaiian dance party or something. It gets tough with the winter for sure. And but, you know, we've been pretty lucky. Like, we've never had any horrible blizzards, really, or anything like that. But
John, wasn't there a time, I remember us talking to you on the road, when you guys were doing this by bus?
You were pretty much replicating the way that Buddy Holly did it.
Yeah, we did it the first year, 1999. We did the exact routing it did, which was totally insane.
It was.
It was like a pentagram tour or something. And I don't know what we were thinking, but I just wanted to kind of see what kind of hardships they went through. And boy, did I experienced it. I like lost my voice in the last show.
Yes.
It was insane.
It was brutal. I remember it was kind of scary, too.
And I think it was back in the day, didn't their booking agent literally just kind of throw a dart at a map and you went from one side of the country to the other side of the country, and that's how they did it?
Yeah, it seemed like there was just no planning at all. It was just kind of like what venue is available, and they would book them there and not even consider, oh gosh, that's 8 hours away, you know?
Yeah.
You know, rock stars in today's era just would never have been treated like that. But that back then, I think it was just kind of common way of dealing with them.
Okay. We have a proposition for you.
Sure.
The proposition is, when the album comes out, would you be willing to come back on the show with us and we'll do an on-air album release party when it's ready?
Good.
That'd be awesome.
And we can talk about these stories about you driving around with mom and pop and that VW bus. I mean, that's like a little movie that plays in your head when you're listening to the song.
Are you working on a video for that? Because there was a video playing in my head as we were listening to that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've got, I'm going to use some actual real photos that I found in my mom's scrapbook and stuff. And,
good.
Yeah, I'm really excited by the video is just like it's going to be like a movie kind of thing. Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, let's definitely plan on doing something. I mean, we'll just, if you happen to be someplace in the Midwest, it'll be great. But otherwise, we'll track you down wherever you are in the world when that CD is available to the public.
Oh, that's awesome. I appreciate it. That'd be great.
And folks can see you in the winter dance party as Buddy Holly with the whole gang, and that's going to be at the Rouse Center for the Arts, and that is on February 20th in Crystal Lake. Before that, Shipshewani, our listeners in Indiana, the winter dance party will be at the Blue Gate Theater on the 19th, and then in Carthage on the 21st at the Legacy Theater in Carthage, Illinois. John, you get some rest. You got to hit the road, but thank you so much for joining us after your show tonight in Ohio.
Oh, thank you so much. It's always great to talk to you guys. Love you.
Love you, too. Take care now.
Thank you, John.
Be careful. Bye-bye.
And you can check out, John has a ton of websites. You can go to yourbuddyjohn.com. You can go to winterdanceparty.com. And we will put some of the links on our blog. And again, we will premiere John's album yes. when it comes out.
But if you like the music of Buddy Holly, the man does it right. Yeah. And you can see him at the Rouse Center on the 20th of February.
I'm going to signal for a turn here. Sadly, one of the great distinctive voices of rock and roll, Chuck Negron. Chuck, who was a founding member of Three Dog Night, passed away on Monday. He was 83 years old, and he had been dealing with some serious health issues for many years.
We were lucky enough to talk to him a couple times. He's such a sweet man, just so humble, and that was his voice.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in my opinion, one of the greatest voices in rock and roll music. He gave his joy to the world. It was him singing lead on Easy to Be Hard.
Yeah.
Old-fashioned love song.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Out in the Country. Was that him singing lead
on
that?
Yeah, I think he probably was. First time I ever met them, we really didn't get to meet, was back in the 60s, I want to say roughly 68, 9-ish, I was working in Gary at WLTH, and one had just started to happen, and we were sponsoring a concert. It was, if I recall correctly, it was at the Hammond Civic Center, and there were two acts. Three Dog Night was the headline act. The opening act, I will never forget because I always liked them and thought they were going to be bigger, Pinkney Canandy, which it's a silly name. I love their stuff. But Three Dog Night was the headliner. And it was years, it would have been when you and I came to WGN that we finally got to talk with Chuck. But in the interim, I remember going in the 70s to at least four Three Dog Night concerts in the International Amphitheater. They were wonderful.
I was at the same concert you were at. And to me, when I look back on all of the concerts that I saw during that period of time, I mean, that included Kenny Loggins, Loggins and Messina, Fleetwood Mac, Foreigner, Paul McCartney and Wings. I still felt like those Three Dog Night concerts were right there at the top of my favorite shows, shows.
I wonder if you had the same thought that I did. And in retrospect, it even solidifies more in my head. Go back to the 70s, late 60s, early 70s. Sound systems were not that good.
Right.
As we were talking with Howard Levy, just lots of speakers, but not really good sound systems. And yet, at the International Amphitheater, which was a barn, Three Dog Night's harmony was impeccable.
And they could go from a song like a Out in the Country and a screamer, and you heard it, and they put on a great stage show, too. I mean, they were such a tight band.
If you ever get the chance, pick up Chuck's book, Three Dog Nightmare. I believe it has been reissued. It is a very open, very candid explanation of how he got involved in drugs. And how that ultimately led to the other members of Three Dog Night after they had welcomed him back a couple times, and it got to the point where, no, this just isn't going to work.
Right.
And he was just down a very bad place.
Because they were at the height of their career from 69 to well into the mid to late 70s. I want to say something like 20 top 40 hits, 60, 70 million records were sold, sold out concerts every city that they traveled to.
One of the best live albums you will ever hear. If you get the chance, pick up Three Dog Night live at the Forum.
It is
one of the definitive, really, really, oh boy, is it a good live album.
Three Dog Nightmare, believe it or not, has gone into its fourth edition, including 11 never-before-published chapters of his own words. Interesting, we were talking with Howard Levy about his book and how he had to whittle it down to 88 stories, chapters in his book. And he said, gee, you know, there's probably another book there. Well, Chuck Negron had 11 more chapters that they've added. So the fourth edition, if you want the book, Three Dog Nightmare, that's what you want, the very latest one, the fourth edition.
Somewhere in our, in fact, we had the conversation with some friends this week. We have a pretty extensive audio archive of the things that have happened on our show over the years. Sadly, it's stuff that WGN doesn't have. Part of this has to do with digitizing things. But we're going to try to get to some of our audio archives and get them into a digital form where we could let you hear some of these conversations. Because we've got reel-to-reel tapes, we've got DATs, we've got mini discs, we've got a ton of things. Anytime anybody came in, we made sure we had a copy of the audio.
And I'm looking at the cover of that book, and it all comes back to me because of that horrible picture of Chuck Negron, a close-up of him with the tape across his nose, where his nose is broken, and he looks like he's just out of it. And I remember he talked very openly about those dark, dark days in his life, and that's why he wanted that picture on the cover, is to get people's attention. And, you know, here he's living the clean life, and sadly, as you said, he was not well enough to do a lot of traveling in recent years because he had COPD, and he was just generally compromised, and just it just wore him out.
He had, after we initially talked with him about his book, he'd come out with a wonderful Christmas album. And a couple other albums.
He still had the voice.
Oh, boy, his voice never left him. But if you haven't listened to any Three Dog Night in a while, listen to it. And remember a man with, as Johnny said, one of the definitive voices in rock and roll music. Just a sad loss. That sound means we are about to launch into the world of cyberspace with a man who is the Director of Educational Technology of the Keck School of Medicine of USC. And more importantly, he is part of Joseph's posse. That would be Dr. Patrick Crispin. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, Patrick.
Woohoo! How are you guys doing?
Good. Seems like forever since we talked to you.
I know. What
it's
happened?
Crazy. I know.
And you've had that horrible cold snap on your side of the planet.
You're an evil man. You know it?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I will tell you right now, it is 70 degrees now in Pasadena.
That's crazy. And you send pictures, which I love. And you guys are running around in shorts and T-shirts.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, we're looking at a driveway that's still covered with snow. You know, come on. I know. This is unusual, though, isn't it? It's unusually warm.
It is a little warm. It's going to be 84 tomorrow, which is like, what?
Yeah,
I think it's possibly going to be in the 40s at some point this week for us.
Yes.
We have so much stuff to get to. But before we get to any of the stuff that that is planned, I want to throw something out. As you know, I have been known to download about 97 different browsers.
Of course.
And I just downloaded a new one this week. I know nothing about it, but it looked kind of interesting. And I'm curious to hear what you know about LibreWolf.
I've never heard of it.
Okay. Wait, you mean I've got one?
And it's one word, right? LibreWolf.
Yeah, I think it's LibreWolf. And apparently it is, at least from what I've read about it, a more secure version of Firefox.
They claim that it was designed to increase protection against tracking and fingerprinting techniques, while also including a few security improvements. How did you hear about this, Steve? Because when you said it, I said, what?
And I'm trying to think where the heck I heard about it.
And why would you jump into it without asking questions first?
Well, A, it's based on Firefox. So I knew, you know, okay, that's a good thing. And it, in downloading it, it seems like it doesn't have a whole lot of bells and whistles, like it's a really stripped down version and it's trying to keep things stripped down and not do a whole lot of add-ons and other things. And I've only used it very sparingly so far, but I'm just curious about it, and I was curious to know if you knew anything about it.
So they're calling it a custom version of Firefox.
Yeah, so it sounds like what in the software world, what we call a fork, where you basically take the code base and say, okay, we're no longer going to follow the Firefox code base. We're going to take the Firefox code base and go off on our own direction and add new bells and whistles and features separate from what's going on in Firefox. The positive thing is they can now go and do some different things and go in a different direction. The negative thing is, if Firefox adds new bells and whistles over on the Firefox code, there's no guarantee that it's going to go over to the forked browser or not.
Mm-hmm. So you could end up being limited in what you want to do with this browser.
Yep. And some features, for example, you know, my guess is that with Firefox, one of the selling points is that you can sync things like your bookmarks and there's questions of, is syncing going to work on a forked browser or not? I don't know. We'll just have to test it.
Mm-hmm. And as I've read about it, it's like they don't really want a whole lot of bells and whistles. They're just saying, okay, you can go to this website and not worry about people tracking you, following you, blah, blah, blah. Period. End of story. That's kind of what I'm understanding about it.
They also.
Take care of that by basically running a whole bunch of Firefox extensions that kind of make it much more difficult for websites to track me. But again, this is intriguing on how there's a different version of Firefox out there that's not made by the Mozilla Foundation, but actually taken by a group of people and saying, okay, we're going to go in a different direction.
It's only available for your desktops, and they do admit that there are people that should avoid it, and those people are the casual users who want a browser that just, quote, works with everything.
Right.
So if you decide to leap to Libra Wolf, which is a very strange name for it, Libra Wolf, all one word. There's got to be some great story behind that. But if you decide to do it, you may find that it's not playing well with everything that you like to do on your computer.
And their security upgrade cadence might not be as strict as Firefox's.
Oh. Yet they're all about privacy.
Yeah.
Right.
Interesting. Okay, well, leave it to Steve. Is that like number 14 you've got on your machine?
Okay, at this point, we've got Libra Wolf, Opera, I can't think of the one that starts with a V, and I always blank out.
Vivaldi.
Mm-hmm.
Chrome.
Brave.
Edge.
Edge.
Stop.
There's something else in there, too. So it's about six or seven different browsers. And one of the reasons I do this is, it is very common for us to discover we're trying to go to one particular website and it won't, for whatever reason, it won't play well with whatever browser we're using. Well, okay, we have a different browser that we can try to go to the website with.
I'm looking at information on Libra Wolf. And Patrick, you may not know an answer to this, but I've found this was weird. They've got it highlighted in the description of Libra Wolf. It's designed to increase protection against tracking and fingerprinting techniques. How do fingerprinting techniques come into play if you're not using it on a mobile device?
Well, the way it works is that when you are connecting to a website, you're giving them your IP address. They're also knowing what browser you're using. They know where you're located. They know the time of day. They might get some information on the screen resolution that you're having. And as you visit more and more sites, they can put together a a fingerprint of who you are, even though they don't know who you are. So you can kind of guess, oh, okay, this is a person who's always doing at 800 by 600.
So it's like a profile
on Windows 95. Exactly. It's a profile on your browser. Their browser and your computer.
So it's not a literal fingerprint. But it's they're saying, okay,
it's just
we're going to make it more difficult for people to find out all this stuff about
you.
I don't think I've ever seen the word used like that, though, because it's kind of confusing. Because I thought, well, why would I be worried about fingerprinting on my desktop?
Yeah, it's not actually your physical fingerprint. It's a code-based guess on who you are based on your browsing pattern.
Well, as we said forever, you ain't born knowing this stuff.
Yeah.
So that was my question for the night. Okay, so big news. It's now TikTok USA, right?
Well, unofficially, yes. It's actually the real name of it, and this just rolls off the tongue, is now TikTok USDS Joint Venture LLC.
Well, if you talk to people who are actively use TikTok, there's been a lot of upheaval in the past week.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the beginning. What happened?
So remember, there are about 82 million people who use TikTok every day. I mean, 82 million in the United States. They spend between 52 and 58 minutes a day using the app. It is addictive as heck. Right at the end of the Biden administration, actually during the Biden administration and initiated during the last Trump administration, a ban was put in place on TikTok saying that because it's owned by China and because there are some national security risks, that unless TikTok divested itself and sold itself or part of it to an American company, they would be banned. And that ban was to go into place the day before Donald Trump became president, which was the second time. Donald Trump said, no, we're not going to enforce that. I want to come up with a deal, and spent a long time. That deal has been consummated. And there is now a U.S.-controlled version of TikTok. It's separate from the global version of TikTok. It's a U.S. version. It launched last week. And it is official. It now complies with federal law limiting foreign control over apps deemed to be national security risk. And the way they did it was they took Oracle and Silver Lake and MGX and a whole bunch of other U.S. allied investors and basically set up a brand new company, that TikTok USDS Joint Venture LLC. Let's just call it TikTok USA. The parent company, ByteDance, still is a Chinese company, and they still have about a 20%, 19.9% ownership of this. But the new TikTok American version is up and running. And I apologize. I thought we would all have to download a new version of the TikTok app, and you don't. They found out a way to do it. So if you have TikTok, you have been using the TikTok USA app, whether you know it or not. That said, the launch of that, well,
it was icky.
It was bumpy.
Yeah,
it was there was a multi-day outage that a lot of people on TikTok realized, I can't get into TikTok anymore. What's going on?
Well, wait a minute. How about the people who could get in, the creators? There was a lot of gnashing of teeth, people saying, what's with this terms of service?
Terms of service or zero views on feeds. And it's just like,
people were claiming that they were seeing that their numbers were just tanking. And then there was some question about, is content being watched? And as a result of content, there's a decision that maybe you shouldn't be able to show this on TikTok.
There was actually speculation that they were sort of downgrading or not promoting things on about ICE or sensitive topics. So, for example, you talked about Epstein, that was being pushed down during the transition. TikTok says, you know, we just had a data issue. It's not a long-term issue. Don't worry about it. It's a technical issue. It's not intentional moderation. We're not doing anything. So TikTok is continuing to operate. We now have a version, an American version of TikTok. Two questions that kind of pop up, and we've asked this before over the years, is this new American version of TikTok going to feel American? Because the data governance is actually under U.S. control, but the algorithm, the secret sauce, is still owned by ByteDance, which is a Chinese company. And what influence are they going to have on this? Some people have concerns. The other thing is, you know, there was a lot of people in Congress. Congress unanimously passed the law to ban TikTok, and now we've kind of given it a reprieve. Are people going to trust this? Are we going to, I mean, are you going to trust it more than if it was under Chinese ownership? And I think we're still at the early stages. We just have to see. But if you're part of the 82 million people who use TikTok, it's here. It's not going away. It's now running out of America. And let's see what happens next.
Hmm. Well, that was going to be my bottom line question. Do you trust it? And the jury is still out.
Yeah.
I don't use TikTok. My life is fine without it.
Well, I was actually afraid to go there because it is so addictive.
I'm kind of the same way. Is I know people who use it. They use it for an hour a day or more, and it's like, I don't have an hour a day to spare. I know I want to. I know I'm missing a lot of things, but I know.
Well, see, I did follow all of the grumbling last week, and I mean, I don't know how, even though I don't follow TikTok, I was seeing so many people saying, this is outrageous. You know, I am a successful TikTok user. I'm an influencer. I'm a creator, whatever. And they were giving specs about how their life was changed literally overnight by this change. And in many cases, it means dollars that they lose.
Sure.
They're making good money using TikTok.
Sticking with social media for a second. And I know we have harangued about Facebook a lot. What's going on with Facebook? Johnny has noticed some really glitchy, strange things this week. I have too. I am becoming so annoyed with Facebook. This is why we're trying to move people over to Blue Sky and to our blog and some other things. The things that I look for in my feed are rarely coming up.
Yeah.
If Johnny and I talk about going to the store to get a new kind of orange pop, that orange pop and related orange pop items will show up in our Facebook feed.
But the things I really want aren't there.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's really it's a combination of two things. It's algorithms and it's advertising. And the reality is that if you're not paying for something, you're the product. And basically, if you go and search online for I'm looking for the new orange soda, there are going to be advertisers who are going to say, oh, Steve is looking for the new orange soda. I'm going to pay money to Facebook to advertise my orange soda. And then other people, oh, I have orange soda too. Mm-hmm. Let me advertise that as well. So it's really tracking you as you go around the internet and following you and then selling your information so that they can make more money. That's what Facebook is. It started out as being a way for you to connect to your friends, but the reality is it is a business for Facebook to sell advertising. And if they can get you to keep scrolling and keep scrolling and keep scrolling, looking for the things that used to be there from your friends, but are now, you know, garbage from advertisers, they're making more money by doing that. That actually is a positive thing for them.
If you can, do a little bit of a search for Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees.
I saw that.
Mickey Dolenz posted a video. I want to say it was just about in the past day or so, where he is telling his fans, if you see blah, blah, blah from Mickey Dolenz, it ain't me. Mm. Apparently, there have been a whole lot of fake Mickey Dolenz stories. And he takes a few minutes and he just breaks it down and says, look, this is all about the algorithms. And if they're saying that Mickey Dolenz is out on Fifth Avenue dressed as a horse and he's singing opera, and if it gets you to click on that, whoopee.
That click is how they make their money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's engagement farming. And you're sitting there saying, this is wrong. This is not true. Mm-hmm. I know this is not true. Guess what? The person who posted the bad thing is getting paid for it.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You need to just move on and not engage with this.
Well, on that line, let me mention that if you get into a series of comments, so you find something that interests you and you want to read the comments, or maybe you want to make a comment, I'm seeing that there's one comment that has popped up at least a dozen times in the past few days for me. It'd be completely unrelated. So I'm looking at a cooking page, right? And I go to the comments, and there in the middle of the comments is, Joe Biden's health is really bad.
Yeah.
And you want,
there are so many AI bots out there.
Yes.
Now. It's the idea of something, and do a search for dead internet theory, which is the idea that human beings are being replaced by bots who are posting things, and you have no idea what's a real person's post or some computer program that's trying to get you to click or engage or just do bad things.
Is somebody making money, though, with it? For example, this Biden is sick or Biden is really sick post. I mean, there are variations, but it's always him and it's always his health that I've seen about a dozen times. Somebody's making money from that?
It could be, or it could just be somebody who's decided to be completely evil and just post stuff
to
for
get people
any
wild,
reason.
Yeah, to get people riled up.
And there's fake stories that are being posted on both sides. So it's,
oh, sure. Yeah. Patrick, a listener said, can you please take a moment and explain what is TikTok Lite?
Yeah, and really it's a sort of stripped down version of TikTok. And it's designed for people who are on slow phones or slow networks.
Oh.
So it's actually designed for countries where there isn't a lot of extensive internet everywhere, mm-hmm. or there's countries where people have older phones, or there's just a bunch of people who don't want to keep scrolling and scrolling and scrolling and eating up their data cap. So we're talking places like Southeast Asia and Africa and mm-hmm. Latin America. But what it does is it basically is giving you shorter videos. It's going to give you the ability to scroll through your feed, but it's going to be nicer on your mobile data. And if you have a really older phone, it's going to work just a little bit better. The videos are going to be lower resolution. There's not going to be a lot of stuff running in the background on it. But again, if you have an old phone, or you've got a plan that doesn't allow you to use a lot of data, TikTok Lite is maybe something to look at.
And mm-hmm. do you just look for it by looking up TikTok Lite?
Yep. Lite.
Okay.
Okay.
Listener from 847, this is Ken. He says, I'm driving and listening to the conversation about all the issues with Facebook and TikTok. You know, we were so much better off growing up back in the day without all this stuff, when the only biggest problem was searching around to make sure you could find a payphone. And then, do you have a dime to make that phone call?
I remember
those were
days.
The challenges.
We want to move on to something we started talking about last time you were with us, passkeys.
Yes. So we were talking about what a passkey is, and we all know about usernames and passwords, but passkeys is sort of the next evolution of it. And I want to kind of – we had some questions about what it does and how it works, and do you really have to unlock your phone with your biometric data, or do you have to unlock your computer? So I want to kind of go back up and talk about what's going on. So you have a passkey that's stored on your computer, and you get that for every single website that you want to log into that has an account. And when you go back to that website and you sign in using the passkey, instead of being asked to, okay, what is your username? What is your password? The website actually asks your computer, saying, you know, I know you've got a passkey on it. Can you share that passkey with me? I just want to make sure that you're allowed to come into my site without you having to do anything except one other thing. So the thing that you've got to do is you've got to you're prompted to unlock your device the same way you normally do. So however you unlock your phone or your computer, that could be Face ID, it could be Touch ID, it could be a fingerprint, it can be a PIN or a password or something like that. It's however you normally log into your device, that's actually the way you do it. Or a pattern if you're using Android, where you kind of draw the numbers. Once you kind of do that, then it says, okay, I'm going to give the key to the website. And the website says, yep, it's you. Come on in. Mm-hmm. So why is that better than a password? Remember, with a password is a shared secret, but if somebody has the username and password, they can sign in. Passkeys aren't shared at all. Nothing reusable is typed by you or sent by you. You have this key that's stored on your computer and sort of is used to unlock the remote website, but there's no password database that anybody could steal. And we talked about password databases being breached along. And more importantly, if somebody tries to phish you and say, oh, I want you to type, you need to log into this website, mm-hmm. and they pretend it's Microsoft.com, but it's actually RNicrosoft, mm-hmm. and RN together looks like Microsoft, mm-hmm. and your computer's going to sit there and say, I don't have a passkey for RNicrosoft.com. I have a passkey for Microsoft. That's not the real site. I'm not going to let you in. And it just is there to protect you. So the questions that Steve asked last week, and these are really good questions, is, well, why can't somebody just steal the passkey off of my computer? If the passkey is stored on my computer, can't somebody steal it? And the answer is no, because the passkeys are actually stored in a special part of the hardware on your computer that is not readable by any human being. You can't see it. You can't read it. It's in the Windows PCs. It's called the Trust and Platform module. In the Apple devices, so if it's a Mac, an iPhone, an iPad, you use something called Secure Enclave. And then if you have an Android, it's either Trusted Execution Environment or Strongbox. But these things are not visible to any human being. It's basically your computer goes into this area and pulls out the key and sends it out, but the key is useless unless there's a match at the other end. So basically, it's stored in this hardware area on your computer using cryptographic keys, and there's just no way that it can get off of your device.
So what happens, pardon me, but I remember my big concern was, what happens if I lose my key or access to my key?
And it's actually a great question. The answer is, if you lose your key, you can go and recover the key from the website using your device, or you can sign in with a different device. Some places will still allow you to sign in with your old username and password if you want to. And it will simply just work.
So if you've lost the key,
right,
you go back to the website, it's going to say, okay, prove to us you're you, and you would sign on the same way that, for example, you would start your phone from ground zero, and my PIN is 1234.
Exactly.
You would put that in, and it says, oh, okay, it's Johnny's phone, and so we're okay.
Okay,
gets even better. I want to jump ahead to this next part, which is, do I have to store the passkey on my computer? Can I store it someplace else? And the answer is yes. In fact, if you are using an iPhone, the iCloud keychain is Apple's keychain for passcodes or passkeys that is stored in the cloud. If you're using Google Password Manager, passkeys are stored in the cloud. If you use Microsoft Account Syncing, passkeys are stored in the cloud. If you use 1Password, passkeys are stored in the cloud. As long as you can get into those accounts, your passkeys are there for you on every device that you use.
So speaking of every device, I have multiple devices. Do I have multiple passkeys from my phone, my tablet, my laptop, my desktop? Are they all different?
It can be. It depends on where, on how you sign in and where your keys are stored. So you could have a passkey that is stored for your desktop and for your laptop and for your phone. Or if you're using a password manager like iCloud Keychain, Google Password Manager, Microsoft Account Syncing, 1Password, those keys then would be stored and you'd only have one key.
Okay. I know the last time we touched on this, people were concerned about vulnerability, but somebody being able to get it. And yet you're saying it's so much more
so
safe.
Much better.
Yeah.
Okay. I shouldn't go here, but I will. My pea-sized brain is going to say, okay, this is stored in a place on your computer that no human can get to. But what if a human has created a machine that is capable of going in and digitally saying, oh, here's where it is?
Well, like a website?
The hardware has protection in it to protect the exfiltration of data, except for the person who needs the key. And even in that case, the key is useless unless you have the other key at the other end to go put the two together
right. To
let you in. So
we have to remember that, because I think in our minds, we're still
thinking. It's two part.
Yeah, thinking it's one part.
Our heads are still hurting.
No, I really want to do this. And that's why I'm glad we're revisiting it, because, you know, I have my fears. I know we had responses from people saying, well, it sounds like a grand idea, and I certainly trust what Patrick is telling me, but we have to remember it's two parts. Yep. Unlike a password.
Yep.
You have to
you're going to have a key on your computer that only fits into a lock that is sitting on the remote server, and your key is unique for you.
That's how we
and
have
no
to
one
look
else
at
can
it.
Use it.
A key and a lock. The key does nothing without the lock, and that lock is yours.
And the key is yours. The lock is the website.
Right. Okay.
If you want to find out more about this, FIDO Alliance Passkeys Directory, I've got a link to it in the show notes. FIDO is the Fast Identification Online. It's the standard, and you go look at everybody who signed up for passkeys, and it's like, oh, okay, everybody's using this.
And again, if you are glazing over at everything we're talking about, don't worry. It will all show up in the show notes on our blog.
Like FIDO Alliance. And that's FIDO as in here, doggy.
Woof, woof.
Yeah.
Woof, woof.
Right. I'm glad we revisited, because I've got to take the leap. The last time I'm going to do this. And during a break, I checked it out and went, no, I don't think so. I'm comfortable with my passwords, which is stupid. We got to get with the program. So show notes will have all of these details. And a lot of people are saying, thank you for saying that you're scared, because I'm scared too. But we're going to get over that.
We have so much stuff we want to try and get to and a little amount of time to do it. We want to talk a little bit about smart TVs, Patrick, right?
Yeah. Kim Komando actually posted something online, and there's a long quote here, which is, you aren't the customer when it comes to TVs. You're the product. While you watch TV, it watches you right back. It's called ACR, and it takes a screenshot of every screen every few seconds to build a profile on you. It tracks what you watch, when you watch it, and even what you play on your console.
Then it sells
that information to advertisers and data brokers. And it's like, yeah, kind of, but not really. Sorry, Kim Komando is fantastic. I love her to death. That's a little exaggerated. TVs don't go for it.
A jargon alert. ACR, automatic content?
Automatic content recognition.
Recognition, okay.
So TVs are not actually recording everything that's going on your screen and not doing screenshots. What it's doing, though, is it is kind of taking a thumbprint, kind of a video fingerprint of what's going on your device. Sort of like if you've ever had Shazam, it's like, hey, can you identify this music? Shazam kind of does a thumbprint from what the music's going on. She is right that TV prices are kind of subsidized, but not as much as you want. So what you're doing is you're paying for the hardware, and the manufacturers are also going and selling advertising and data partnerships and things like that. And they have apps. So when you buy a TV, you're both the customer and the data source. So both are true. Kim talks about how you can turn off ACR, the automatic content recognition, and you can if you want to. I don't think that's going to do much.
What if you just don't connect to Wi-Fi?
Yeah, I mean, you can. You can just basically don't connect to the Wi-Fi, or, you know, don't use the TV as a smart display. And if you need to block telemetry at the network level, if you are connecting it to the network, that's one way to do it. If you want to disable it, I pulled in a show notes of how to disable it on Samsung, LG, and Vizio TVs. This is from Tom's Guide. The thing I kind of, when I heard about this, it was like, yeah, I know I'm being tracked. This isn't surprising.
Everything is tracking me.
I mean, when I'm watching cable TV, the cable providers know what I'm watching for how long. If I'm streaming on Netflix or whatever, they know what I watch, when, what device, where it's located. if I'm watching YouTube, YouTube is tracking at such granular level. They're knowing how fast I play, when I hit pause, when I stop watching in a video, what time of day I'm watching, what devices I'm with. ISPs, your internet service provider, they're tracking you. Turning off ACR on your TV doesn't stop that. So my kind of takeaway is, and I respect Kim tremendously, but you can't be both connected and anonymous. Mm-hmm. If your device is online, if you're connected on a phone or a computer or a TV or a thermostat or your refrigerator, some computer company out there is collecting usage data of what you're doing so they can monetize it. That's mm-hmm. just a trade-off of being online.
If you decided that you wanted to go through the process of just shutting it down so ACR was not available,
yeah,
would you still just be able to watch your television?
Of course.
Just no bells and whistles? Is it kind of stripped down?
It's just not reporting on you. It doesn't do much damage or things, but you can turn it off if you want to. I'm not sure what benefit that mm-hmm. serves, but you can.
Hmm.
Okay, speaking of, is your TV watching you? And we're sort of getting into the world of privacy. So let's segue a little bit into phone privacy and things like that.
Yeah, there was a post that was on Facebook recently saying that the police now assign everybody a social score or threat score using AI. And it's based on where you go, what you know, what you post. And like a lot of these stories, they tell you that you can protect yourself by changing a few phone settings. Well, they don't have a social score for you, and you can't protect yourself by changing phone settings. There isn't a national score that tracks everybody. There is in China, but there's not here. U.S. law enforcement does use technology. There's predictive policing tools, facial recognition, license plate readers, mm-hmm. but they're in databases that are not necessarily connected to each other. So there's no signal of universal score following you around for your entire life, and you can't turn it off on your phone. And we can talk about predictive policing, but the reality is the phone settings myth tells you if you go off and go and turn web and app activity off and turn off personalized ads, it protects you. It doesn't. All that does is it protects you from commercial data collection by Google or Apple or Microsoft or Meta. Doesn't do anything about the government databases. If you're concerned about the government spying on you, you need to be living in a cabin in the woods. and your cellular provider still knows where you are, when mm-hmm. you're connected, what you're doing, and court orders still exist. The metadata still exists. Your phone privacy settings, they're about ads, not surveillance. Turning that off doesn't protect you from the government. So just be aware that if you're hanging out with people who are known to do bad things, the government is going to track you and know that you're hanging out with people who are doing bad things, even if you haven't done anything wrong. If you are attending a high-risk event, leave all your technology at home. No technology. And that then cuts down on real-time tracking. And the takeaway here is there's no threat score that's a national threat score based on who your friend. And there's no magic setting in your phone that makes you invisible to the government. It's another Facebook lie. If there's a viral post saying, here's how to fix things on your computer, they're trying to make you hurt your computer or your phone. Privacy is not a switch you flip. It's a set of trade-offs that you manage.
Okay, just for the sake of argument, if you're attending a high-risk event, get a burner phone?
You can, but that also looks really, really kind of suspicious for you because it's like, okay, well, why did you bring that here? And it could be used against you.
Yeah, but if I'm going to be someplace with a couple hundred thousand people, I think I want to have a phone with me in case something happens.
Sense.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it's a trade-off, as you say. You've got to decide what kind of risks are you willing to take, and here's the reality. And
the key thing is, remember, even if you don't, if you go to a high-risk event, no devices doesn't mean anonymity. You're still being identified through cameras, through license plate readers, transaction records, other people's phones. Leaving your phone at home reduces one attack surface, but it doesn't make you invisible.
Other people's phones?
Yeah, if you're using their phone.
Oh, okay. I was like,
or if they're taking pictures, or if they're there streaming it and taking pictures.
Oh, when you're there in it. Okay. Yeah. 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 Okay. So if you're at a protest, you're at a rally, some kind of march, and then somebody's doing video and you're in that video and you've left your phone at home, well, you've been captured. You're there.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yep.
Okay. Before we wrap up, what's the deal with Siri?
This is big news for the folks who are the 70% of the people who are listening who have iPhones. Siri has just been, well, it's garbage. It's just horrible. Apple announced 2 years ago Apple's intelligence, and then they didn't do anything about it. It looks like Apple is now licensing Google, and not like Google Gemini. Uh-huh. So the next foundation of Apple foundation models were going to be based on Google Gemini and cloud technology. And so Google Gemini is going to power the next version of Siri, which is coming, some are saying, like, March or April, like iOS 26.4. I expect to see big announcements at Worldwide Developers Conference in June, but the new version of Siri could actually be powered by Google Gemini. It's still going to be Siri, but it's going to be powered by Google.
Hmm. You're not real happy about that, are you?
If Siri can work.
Just make Siri work.
You've never been a Siri fan.
We were in the car out here, and we were just asking, how far are we from the ocean?
Yep.
And so I asked Siri, how far are we from the ocean? And it said, San Bernardino is 1 hour and 50 minutes away. And it's like, San Bernardino isn't the ocean.
That's right. Wow. What's on the agenda for your hot week ahead?
Honestly, we are just kind of we're at birthday parties today. Mm-hmm. Abigail turned 10, one of Joseph's best friends.
Yes.
So Joseph is getting ready for his birthday. We've got our passes now for the Grand Canyon.
Yay!
So Joseph is now official for that. So we're looking forward to that for his spring break. And
we're all going to the Grand Canyon.
We are all going to the Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm. For our spring break. I'm excited because it's only 2 months away.
I know.
And it'll probably snow because the boy has that kind of power. It's going to snow.
He does that. He does that.
Well, hug him for us, and thanks a million, Patrick.
Thanks. Talk to you soon.
Have a good week. Bye-bye. Okay, we're rapidly running out of time because we only had 5 hours to talk tonight.
Yeah.
So we're going to make our first caller our last caller of the night, and let's go for it.
Okay, caller number one would be Mike.
Mike.
And Mike, where are you calling from?
Elmwood Park.
Hey, Mike, how are you tonight?
I'm doing good. I'm recovering from bypass surgery.
Oh, God bless you.
Wow.
Wow, you sound great.
Yeah, about 3 weeks ago, I had it. And so far, so good.
I hope it's not too personal, but I'm curious, was it a surprise? Did you go in for
it? No. I had an angiogram in August last year, and they told me there was 3, arteries. They went on top of my heart. They didn't go inside.
Oh,
that's interesting.
And they give me a 4 to 6 week recovery, which is going well, and I'll go back to work in March.
Are you feeling good? Do you feel different?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
Totally. I recovered so quick that they're really surprised. I mean, I had it done at Loyola.
Mm-hmm.
And the surgeon was a top-notch surgeon. He was surprising too,
Yeah, that's great. I also
medical technology today is just incredible.
Oh, yeah.
You had your angiogram in August. I had one in August as well. And to this day, I stand back in awe. You know, going into it, I'd taken a stress test, and they said, oh, we think that you need to have an angiogram as a result of your stress test. And so, of course, I'm terrified, right?
Oh, sure.
And the cool thing is, after you go through the procedure, you know what your situation is. You know what your heart's condition is. That was amazing.
Yeah. I had angioplasty about 5 years ago. And they did 2 of my arteries, and those 2 are still open.
Wow.
They are still open since they put the stents. Well, I watch my diet and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll be 73 in October.
But oh, you're a kid.
You sound great.
To look at it. I mean, to look at me and mm-hmm. you'd never think it. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you doing any kind of heart rehab now?
Well, that's coming up.
Good.
I have to get, you know, together with a nurse.
Yeah. And,
to,
yeah.
In coming, well, she's going to call me probably Monday. Mm-hmm. We're going to set up a rehab, you know,
well,
before
good.
I go back.
Yeah, you so know. You've got the month of February to get all this taken care of before you get back to work. So you're still working full time at 73?
Yeah, I work, I'm a crossing guard in River Grove.
Okay.
Oh, they miss you there.
I'm on Grand Avenue, I'm on Thatcher and River Grove Avenue right by the school.
Yeah, that's kind of a busy area, too. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm where the buses turn in. I don't, you know, I have a sign that says, do not enter bus only.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, now, if everything works out, you will go back to work in March, and we'll be thinking of springtime. All of this will be behind us. It just won't be cold and snowy. And
right.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, are you going to be watching the Super Bowl later today?
Yeah, I'm going to a friend's house. He's about 8 blocks away from me. I went to high school with him. He invited me. I said, yeah, I'll be over.
Good, good.
Okay. And, are you normally up at this hour of the morning?
Yeah, normally. I got you guys on every week.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we really appreciate that.
No, you guys make my weekend. You know?
I feel no pressure.
What's your name? Raleigh Jenks. She's good, too.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Well, thank you for listening to GN. In fact, we are going to be sending you out an official WGN Radio T-shirt. For being our first last caller tonight.
They're really cool t-shirts.
And good luck to you. Okay. It's nice talking to you, Mike. And,
yeah, congratulations.
Yeah, take care of yourself.
You know, I was just thinking, what was it? About two or three years ago when Mick Jagger had heart surgery.
Yeah.
And it was like within a couple months, he's up and dancing and just...
Well, I was very fortunate. I don't want to leave people. I don't want to be so vague. Yeah. The good thing was the doctor came back to me and said, wow, this doesn't happen very often.
He said, you've got the heart of someone many years younger than you.
And I said, you're kidding me. And he goes, no, I looked at it. I know what I'm talking about. No blockage. And I said, well, okay. So I think what happened was when I took my stress test, I was too stressed. I literally think I was stressed because I thought, oh, no, I'm going to fail this. And my body reacted and it made them concerned. So it's amazing.
Well, on that note, boy, we are running out of time. Quick reminder, next week we have a full show. It will be our Valentine's Day show.
Yes, yes, yes.
And along with having our car guru, Tom Appel, join us. We're going to do. We're going to check in with any of a number of people who you might have heard of that are couples that have interesting stories. Yeah, we're going to be doing Valentine's Day stuff. John Duncanson and Sylvia Gomez are going to join us. And we might have a few couples that you've heard a few things about on our show over the past several years.
And I'm going to be $500 richer because Seattle's going to win. So it's been a great
Okay, that works for me.
Thank you guys for listening.
Thanks for hanging out with us. Thanks to Bob and Ron and Gabe and Julian, of course, and you for sticking with us. Have a great week and stay safe.